Now, Sadat was assassinated in October of 1981. One of the theories that I have is that among the motivations for his elimination was that he certainly would have raised very strong objections to the brutal Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982. His assassination eliminated an obstacle to the planned Israeli invasion. Note that the Israeli and U.S. national security establishments collaborate very closely and have done so for quite some time. The assassination of Sadat was a brutal one. Sadat took some 28 rounds, yet neither Mr. Mubarak, his successor who was meeting with George Bush, nor Mr. Ghazala, the defense minister who later was a player in the Itzko case, neither of them got a scratch in that assassination, which raises some interesting questions about just exactly how they were able to escape the fusillade that basically shot Anwar Sadat to gristle. More interesting than that, though, and the most suspicious aspect of the assassination, to my way of thinking, was the behavior of Anwar Sadat's security people. Instead of attempting to defend the president that they were trained to defend, they turned their guns on the press corps and said, "No pictures." Now, that's a very, very strange way for a security detail to react. I would note that Sadat's security people were trained by, among others, former CIA operative William Buckley, former because he's now dead, and it was William Buckley who was kidnapped from his situation as station chief in Beirut, Lebanon, and his captivity and his torture at the hands of Islamic fundamentalist terrorists was the rationalization for the weapons transfers to Iran. Basically, among others, CIA Director William Casey were very concerned that William Buckley be gotten out of the hands of his kidnappers. And a note, too, how many of the terrorist incidents, kidnappings, etc., that took place in the 1980s were attributed to Islamic Jihad. And it was the Egyptian branch of Islamic Jihad that is being connected to Sheikh Rahman. Among the incidents being attributed to Islamic Jihad were the bombing of the Beirut barracks, the Marine barracks in Beirut, Lebanon, the downing of the Gander crash, at least in terms of the fundamental investigation. The Gander Newfoundland crash in December of 1985 has been officially ruled an accident, but in fact appears to have been a terrorist incident, and that the chief culprits figure to be Islamic Jihad. They took credit for the blast, and it should be noted that there are indications that that particular bombing, the Gander bombing, was deliberately covered up by elements of the U.S. authorities, because had that investigation been pursued, it might very well have brought to light the Iran-Contra scandal well before it actually came to light. So again, the Sadat assassination is a situation that, like so many others, raises more questions than it answers, but the curious behavior of Sadat's security people, U.S. trained, the odd marksmanship of the assassins, basically they shot Sadat to gristle, but they didn't scratch Hosni Mubarak, his successor, who continued Sadat's policies, and they did not scratch Ghazala, the defense minister on the other side of him, who was later a key player in the Itzko affair. One of the possibilities that I hold open, and one of the possibilities that I think the facts suggest, is that in fact Sadat's assassination may very well have received the assistance, or perhaps the tacit assistance, the complicity, the silence of some of the same elements of U.S. intelligence which have figured in the background of so many of the world's terrorist incidents in the past 15 years. Note, too, that it was in a locker that had been rented by Mohammed Salameh that the chemicals which allegedly were used to make the bomb were found. And again, among the articles that discuss that, an article in the San Jose Mercury News of Saturday, March 6th of 1993, and that this is a Washington Post story, headlined, "Chemicals found in New York blast suspect's locker," subheaded, "Second suspect held without bail." I would also note that in the investigation of this incident, one of the experts who has been involved in this is an individual who had been participated in the investigation of the bombing of the Marine Corps barracks in Beirut and of the Pan Am Flight 103 bombing, and there are indications that elements of U.S. intelligence, this same group, may have been involved in those incidents as well, although once again the operatives at the ground level, the homme de main, appear to have been sincere dupes. And again, we went into the Marine Corps bombing barracks, the Marine barracks bombing in Beirut, in Radio Free America program number 31. We came back to it for a brief period of time in number 38, and Pan Am 103 was discussed at great length in Radio Free America program number 35 and its various addenda. We also touched on that in Radio Free America program number 38, one of the earlier installments. By the way, we also touched on the Gander bombing in number 38 as well. In the New York Times of Thursday, March 4th of 1993, there was a story by Joseph B. Treaster, T-R-E-A-S-T-E-R. This was Dateline New York, March 3rd, headlined, Specialists Sift Explosion Aftermath. Skipping down in the story, we find, on the assumption that the explosion was the work of terrorists, the FBI took the lead in the investigation, and David Williams, the agency's senior explosives analyst who worked on the bombings of the Marine Barracks in Beirut and of Pan Am Flight 103, became the principal coordinator. Together with Daniel Bo, B-O-E-H, a Vietnam War veteran who served on the Pittsburgh Police Force before joining the Treasury's Bureau 16 years ago, he set up a half dozen smaller teams with men and women from the three agencies. One of the aspects of our national security establishment that one has to bear in mind in examining some of its misdeeds is that very often you see some of the same names cropping up over and over in various investigations, and the same people seem to cover up the investigations. Some of the people you will see cropping up over and over in compromise investigations suggests that there are certain individuals who are tabbed periodically to cover up, sort of sanitation experts who are tabbed to cover up the real facts concerning any given investigation and to see to it that the evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of our own national security establishment are covered up. Again, the curious news leaks by the federal officials, bitterly criticized by the New York City law enforcement officials, the alteration or the evolution, perhaps would be a better word, of the journalistic accounts. Initially, we were told that the bomb in the World Trade Center was plastic explosive. Plastic explosives are very tightly controlled, and if in fact plastic explosive was used at some point, the perpetrators have to have been in touch with a military or intelligence agency, because that's the only place you can get a hold of plastic explosive. It is not like dynamite. It is very, very difficult to get a hold of, and people who get a hold of it usually wind up getting busted shortly after it, unless the authorities want them to have it. Also note that Croatian extremists supposedly took credit for the blast ahead of time, which is a very credible element of behavior. That account also evolved. There are indications that perhaps the authorities in this country are actively covering up something vis-a-vis the World Trade Center bombing. And again, I find Mohamed Salameh's behavior a little odd. He seems a little on the clumsy side for a terrorist. Perhaps he's just stupid. Perhaps he's a dupe. Perhaps he's a patsy. Perhaps he was not involved at all. Or perhaps he was under mind control. Unfortunately, mind control is a technique which has been operational for 30 years, but has largely escaped the gaze of the American journalistic community. We went into mind control in Radio Free America shows 5, 6, 7, and a couple of miscellaneous archive shows as well. In fact, we replayed Radio Free America number 5 a couple of weeks ago. I would note again that this particular individual, David Williams, who is heading up the investigation of the World Trade Center bombing, has previously headed up the investigation into the Marine Corps barracks bombing in Beirut, Lebanon, and the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. Despite the official version, the evidence in the Pan Am 103 bombing points strongly in the direction of the Iran-Contra-linked elements of our own national security establishment, those elements that were using Manzar al-Qasar, and there are some serious questions about the Marine Corps barracks bombing as well. Again, the U.S. had advance warning of both incidents and yet was not able to do anything about it. In Radio Free America number 38, we have been examining the complicity of elements of our intelligence system with some of the very terrorists we are told we need to protect ourselves against, because we have been examining and are going to examine further next week the evolution of the counter-terrorist infrastructure within our national security establishment, and specifically we have been taking a look at how counter-terrorism served as the basis and the rationale for setting up infrastructures that were not only utilized by Oliver North and company to bypass the legitimate elements of democratic government in the United States in the Iran-Contra scandal, but beyond that, these elements, these infrastructures are still in place today, and they could be used in the future to completely bypass all elements of American democracy and even perhaps to establish martial law. Later on, we're going to review a section of an article by Peter Dale Scott from Covert Action Information Bulletin, in which Professor Scott discusses how the martial law contingency plans that came to light during the Iran-Contra scandal evolved out of provisions stemming from the Vice President's Task Force on Counterterrorism. And speaking of the U.S. counter-terrorist infrastructure, the U.S. National Security Establishment's counter-terrorist infrastructure, there was an article about that in the San Jose Mercury News of Thursday, March 4th of 1993. This is an L.A. Times article by Ronald J. Ostrow, O-S-T-R-O-W, and Robin Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, of the L.A. Times. It's datelined Washington and headlined, FBI and CIA mobilized swiftly after blast. Skipping down into the article, the explosion at the Trade Center, which killed five people and injured more than 1,000, had triggered the nation's little-known but elaborate anti-terrorism machinery and done so on an unprecedented scale. About a decade ago, the government, concerned by the potent terrorism capabilities of anti-American groups in a number of countries, began expanding and improving its plans, training, and equipment for protecting against such an attack. Quote, I don't think I've ever seen anything bigger except maybe the Kennedy assassination, unquote, said one counterterrorism official. Well, that's an interesting comparison. Again, it is the U.S. counterterrorist capabilities that is the major focus of Radio Free America 38. And ultimately, we are going to be taking a look at how the infrastructures within our national security establishment stemming from the provisions made by as a result of the Vice President's Task Force on Counterterrorism, they have in the past, as I said, been utilized to completely bypass the normal machinery of democratic government in the United States, and in the future they could be used to completely eliminate all vestiges of democracy in this country in response to a, quote, unforeseen, unquote, incident. It's also interesting, too, that this was compared with the Kennedy assassination, because obviously the Kennedy assassination was arguably the most, well, I don't think arguably, it was the most important domestic intelligence operation conducted in the Cold War period. It was literally a coup, disclaimers to the contrary notwithstanding, and it's fascinating. Perhaps this is just an inconsequential reference, or perhaps the individual who made this particular statement knew more than he was letting on here. I would note that the bomb that lit up the World Trade Center it went off in an area where a motor pool of cars used by the Secret Service in various operations in New York was housed. And again, that may have been pure coincidence, but I wonder whether perhaps, among other things, a message was being sent. My suspicion is, and again, I cannot prove it, there's nowhere near enough information to prove it, but my suspicion is that elements of our intelligence system, again, the old Iran-Contra team, the milieu involved in the Turple-Wilson operations, and their faceless cronies within the national security establishment, that they were behind this particular incident. Bill Clinton has not done himself any favors vis-a-vis the military. Many elements of it were suspicious of Bill Clinton, although he had the support of elements of naval intelligence and the Navy during the campaign who were out to get George Bush as part of the war going on within the intelligence community. Bill Clinton was viewed with suspicion because of his evasion of the draft during the Vietnam War, and when one of his first acts was to sanction gays and lesbians in the military, that literally outraged the military, and I suspect that, it may very well be that in addition to destabilizing his administration, a direct message was being sent to Bill Clinton. I certainly think it's odd that the bomb went off in an area where cars used by the Secret Service were housed. One of the questions that I have about our national security establishment, I suspect this is the case but cannot prove it, one of the questions I have is whether or not messages are sent to party or parties, sort of sub rosa, between the lines. When Jimmy Carter in 1979 was talking about completely revamping his administration, he also was making some noises about the Kennedy assassination and was quite vocal about his opinion. It was, of course, an accurate opinion, but his opinion that both Martin Luther King and John Kennedy were assassinated as a result of conspiracies. Shortly after Jimmy Carter began intoning in that regard, there was an odd incident in Los Angeles, and two individuals, one of them named Ray Lee Harvey, and the other one named Oswaldo Ortiz, were arrested for stalking Jimmy Carter with high-powered rifles. No one that I know knows exactly what happened to these two individuals. They were apparently released, but the story very quickly died, and I suspect that basically Jimmy Carter was being sent a message. Basically, shut up, don't talk about reversing the direction of America, because basically you could wind up just like JFK and Martin Luther King. I suspect that the authorities, the situation has evolved to the point where the authorities, the powers that be in this country, can communicate such messages. I don't know whether those are accompanied by behind-the-scenes communication, basically more explicit communication. In the case of Carter, perhaps he was told flat out, shut up, Jimmy, or are you going to get your brains blown out? Or perhaps it was simply allowed it was simply left for Jimmy Carter to read between the lines. But I suspect that perhaps a message is being sent to Bill Clinton. I view the World Trade Center bombing as a probable element in the destabilization of the Clinton administration. I was expecting such a destabilization almost from the beginning. Although many people were very optimistic about the Clinton administration, certainly I was very glad to see George Bush get defeated. I was not particularly optimistic, and within a week of Clinton's election, I was voicing my opinion, roundly criticized, by the way, by many listeners, that Bill Clinton might very well become Jimmy Carter, too. And I warned that the very same national security infrastructure which has basically been running the United States, the same national security infrastructure which assassinated the Kennedys, Martin Luther King, and many lesser-known people with impunity, the same national security infrastructure which has destabilized innumerable governments abroad, the same national security infrastructures that destabilized Jimmy Carter with the October surprise, they are still in place, stronger than ever, and Bill Clinton basically faces that very same situation. And I am afraid that the Clinton administration is already undergoing active destabilization, and I suspect that the World Trade Center bombing is part of it. Whether or not the placing of the bomb in an area that was basically used by the Secret Service, whether that was intended to deliberately send a message or whether that was coincidence, I cannot say. But I suspect that this may very well have been an intelligence community inside joke. The community does like to do things like that, and their capabilities are so enormous at this point that unless there is a serious change of heart on the part of a large section of the American people, the journalistic community in particular, I see no indication whatsoever that the abuses of the past, well, really the abuses of the entire Cold War period, will be reversed. Also interesting to me, too, that in the wake of the JFK movie and the death of Jim Garrison last October, this may very well have been a coincidence, but it was interesting that the World Trade Center bombing went up. The World Trade Center was what was lit up. And it's also interesting to see a counter-terrorist official saying this is the biggest thing since the Kennedy assassination, because the Centro Mondiale Commerciale, the U.S. intelligence front on whose board of directors Clay Shaw sat, Clay Shaw was the individual being pursued by Jim Garrison after David Ferry died, Centro Mondiale Commerciale is Italian for World Trade Center. Again, that may very well be a complete coincidence. There certainly are coincidences, but at the very least, it is an odd coincidence. And I wonder, again, whether perhaps messages are being sent to Bill Clinton, perhaps simply being allowed for him to read between the lines, saying, hey, Billy boy, we can place a bomb in the Secret Service motor pool in New York, and so you better wise up if you don't want to wind up like JFK and others. Or perhaps this is being accompanied by more explicit communication behind the scenes. Perhaps Clinton has been sent a warning. But in any event, I would not be optimistic about the future of the Clinton administration. And once again, I reiterate that the very same forces which destroyed Kennedy, which destroyed Jimmy Carter in a somewhat less bloody fashion, they are in place, they're stronger than ever, and unless something is done to curb their situation, I think we can expect the Clinton administration to basically be the second Carter administration. I would note, too, that the situation of Mohammed Salameh, whether or not he is the participant in this incident that he is alleged to be, that he entered the United States illegally in 1988. Next week, I hope to get to a section of the archive show called Election 88, in which I noted that there were a number of alleged terrorists or potential terrorists making the scene in the United States in the spring and early summer of 1988. And I suspected that with the downing of the Iranian Airbus in 1988, there would be a terrorist reprisal against the United States, quite possibly aided and abetted by the very teams that we have been talking about, the people from the Turple Wilson milieu, the people involved in the Iran-Contra scandal. And indeed, some 6 months after I did that broadcast, in December of 1988, the Pan Am 103 bombing took place, basically fulfilling the, prophecy is a bad word because I'm not religious, but the forecast that I had made in June of that year. I hope to get to this next week. But by the way of the illegal immigrant status of Mohammed Salameh, there was an article about that in the San Francisco Chronicle on March 6th of 1993. This is an article by Nina Bernstein, B-E-R-N-S-T-E-I-N, and Ray Sanchez, S-A-N-C-H-E-Z, of Newsday. It's Dateline New York and headlined, Blast Suspect's Shadowy Life. Subheaded, Apartment was always bustling with activity, neighbors recall. Skipping down in the story, according to Immigration and Naturalization Service officials in Washington, Salameh entered the United States through New York with a Jordanian passport and a tourist visa on February 17, 1988. The visa, issued on December 14, 1987 in Amman, Jordan, expired soon afterward, leaving Salameh here illegally. So note the illegal immigrant status of Mohammed Salameh. We're going to come back to that in just a second. One of the points that I made during the introduction is that in viewing the World Trade Center bombing, one of the possibilities we should consider is that the culprits, if in fact the Islamic fundamentalists, the milieu that's being cited by the media and law enforcement are in fact the perpetrators, that in the background of this is the fascist third position, because that is an explicitly fascist movement which embraces not only extreme left-wing terrorism, but Islamic fundamentalist terrorism in particular. Three of the idols of the fascist third position are Muammar Gaddafi, Ayatollah Khomeini, and Louis Farrakhan. And we looked at the, in the discussions with Farah Mansour, we looked at the collaboration between the U.S. National Security Establishment, the intelligence community in particular, and the Islamic fundamentalists in Iran, whom they tabbed as the successor, the anti-communist successor to the Shah. It's interesting that the money that was wired into the accounts of Nidal A. Ayad and Mohammed Salameh, the money which has come from, which was found in their accounts, not yet directly connected in the investigation to the terrorist incident that they are alleged to have perpetrated, that money came from Germany. And that suggests at least the possibility of the fascist third position figuring into this, because Germany is the epicenter, along with Italy, of the fascist third position. And indeed, we went into the fascist third position in Radio Free America 32 and the aforementioned miscellaneous two-part archive series. By the way, if a lot of the discussion this evening seems really glib and doesn't make a whole lot of sense to new listeners, I apologize. There's simply no way that I can delineate the discussion that has been laid down on a documentary basis over 14 years during the course of the program this evening. Also had a very, very busy week, and frankly, I'm exhausted this evening and not quite as sharp as I might be in terms of the delivery. So if things are a little bumpy, I apologize. But again, for newer listeners, if a lot of the things that I'm saying sound absolutely off the wall and incomprehensible, I apologize, and you have my sympathies. I can understand how that would be the case. Again, I just simply encourage you to get a hold of the archives and examine the massive body of documentation underlying the things that I'm talking about. Once again, the key archive shows, Radio Free America number 4, The Key Archive shows vis-a-vis U.S. involvement in terrorism, quote, left-wing terrorism, unquote. Radio Free America number 4, Radio Free America number 19, talking about the strategy of tension. Radio Free America number 20, 21, 22, 23, 30, 31, 32, 34, 35, the miscellaneous two-part archive series dealing with the fascist third position, the miscellaneous archive show about the Gander Newfoundland bombing slash crash, and the miscellaneous archive show dealing with Election 88, all set forth the relevant documentation. Of the money that was wired into the accounts from Germany, an account of that anyway, was found in the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, March 12th of 1993. In the National Report section of the Chronicle, we find an article, Dateline New York, from the Chronicle Wire Services headlined, Bomb Inquiry Focuses on Money Trail. It reads in part as follows. The men suspected of exploding a bomb underneath the World Trade Center received tens of thousands of dollars from a bank account in Germany, authorities said yesterday. Officials have not determined the precise amount of money or the identity of the source, but they said the discovery might give credence to the theory that the bombing was the act of an international terrorist organization. Although the money received by the suspects, Mohammed A. Salameh, S-A-L-A-M-E-H, and Nidal A. Ayad, A-Y-Y-A-D, at a National Westminster Bank branch in Jersey City, New Jersey, was wired from a bank in Germany, investigators said they suspected it had originated elsewhere. They said they have no proof that the money was spent in connection with the February 26th bombing, which killed 5 people and wounded more than 1,000. So note that some of the money which these people were living off of came from Germany. It may not have been involved in the terrorist incident, as indicated in the story. But I suspect that we will be hearing more about the German connection. I suspect that, in addition to indicating the possibility that this incident was the result of, quote, international terrorists, unquote, and I suspect we will either see a military action abroad, reduced civil liberties, broader surveillance and police powers at home. We may very well see this incident, and it remains to be seen whether other incidents follow. We may very well see this incident being used to justify an aggressive U.S. intelligence posture, both at home and abroad. We may see it used to justify military adventurism abroad, such as the bombing of Libya in 1986 after the LaBelle discotheque bombing, which may very well, in retrospect, have been perpetrated not by Gaddafi's people, but rather by fascist third position individuals fascist third position elements in Germany. It'll be interesting to see the German connection to Mr. Nayad and Mr. Salameh and how it plays. One of the ways in which this incident is already playing is that it is sparking calls for a toughening of U.S. immigration laws. In the Chronicle, the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, March 8th of 1993, there's an L.A. Times story datelined Washington and headlined, Recent Terrorism in U.S. Shows Laxity in Immigration Laws. The article reads in part, The World Trade Center bombing and the recent shooting outside the CIA point to a surprising laxity in U.S. immigration laws that permit foreigners to enter the United States on a temporary visa and to stay indefinitely with virtually no chance of getting caught. Officials of both the Immigration and Naturalization Service and the State Department readily admit that they have no idea how many people fail to depart as promised. Even if they knew that a foreigner had overstayed his visa, they say that they have no way to find him. Skipping down. Until now, no one paid much attention to this virtually unregulated visa system. But the recent highly publicized crimes at the World Trade Center and the CIA have prompted some talk of change on Capitol Hill. Quote, Our borders are much too porous, unquote, Representative Charles E. Schumer, Democrat of New York, said yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation, unquote. Quote, We want to keep them open, but we also have to be much more careful, unquote. The prime suspect in the World Trade Center bombing, Mohammed Salameh, entered the United States in 1988 with a visitor's visa issued at the American Embassy in Amman, Jordan. The Jordanian said that he wanted to come for 1 year to study, but he never returned home. That fact became clear to U.S. officials only after he was arrested in connection with the bombing. Last month, officials had a similarly unpleasant surprise while investigating the murders of 2 CIA employees as they sat in their cars outside the agency's headquarters in a Virginia suburb outside Washington. They learned that the prime suspect, Mir Imal Khansi, M-I-R, or capital M-I-R, capital A-I-M-A-L, capital K-A-N-S-I, had entered the United States in December of 1990 with a visa issued at the American Embassy in Karachi, Pakistan. He said that he was coming on business and would leave within 1 year. And note that the illegal immigrant status of the suspects in both the World Trade Center bombing and in the shooting outside CIA headquarters has sparked cries for a toughening of U.S. immigration law. I would note, too, that, quote, terrorist aliens, unquote, are figured prominently in the development of the martial law contingency plans, which came to light during the Iran-Contra scandal, and that in turn grew out of the various recommendations stemming from the Vice President's Task Force on Counterterrorism. Again, the Vice President at the time was George Bush, who later became President, and was formerly Director of the CIA, and it was while George Bush was Director of the CIA that the Turple Wilson operations were undertaken. They were supposedly rogue agents, but no one who has any serious understanding of the intelligence community and followed that case would take that very seriously. What we saw with the Turple Wilson situation was a classic case of plausible deniability. And the Vice President's Task Force on Counterterrorism, again, as we looked at a few weeks back, was the Garden of Eden, so to speak. It was the generating point, the genesis point for the recommendations that grew out of it and which in turn led to the creation of the national security infrastructures which were used by Oliver North to bypass the law in the Iran-Contra scandal. Beyond that, those same infrastructures that growing out of the Vice President's Task Force on Counterterrorism are in place today. The martial law contingency plans are one of those infrastructures, and those infrastructures could at some point in the future, perhaps not in one fell swoop, but I suspect rather in gradual steps over a period of time, they could be used to completely bypass or, if necessary, eliminate all democratic process in the United States, perhaps setting up martial law and a dictatorship. I'd like to reprise a section of the Peter Dale Scott article that we read into the record a few weeks back. We're going to turn now to Covert Action Information Bulletins, issue number 33. Issue number 33 from the winter of 1990. In Covert Action Information Bulletin number 33, by the way, that publication has now been renamed Covert Action Quarterly. There's an article called Bush and North, the Task Force on Combating Terrorism. That is by University of California at Berkeley Professor Peter Dale Scott, arguably the foremost political consciousness in this country at this time. Certainly a brilliant researcher, and along with people like Michael Parenti, in my opinion, he represents the vanguard of progressive American political consciousness. In this characteristically excellent Peter Dale Scott article, there is a discussion of the martial law contingency plans that grew out of the recommendations made by the Vice President's Task Force on Counterterrorism, and note how, quote, terrorist aliens and the provisions being made to deal with them figure into this scenario. Skipping down in Peter Dale Scott's article, in June of 1986, a new, quote, Alien Border Control Committee, unquote, was established, again quoting, to implement specific recommendations made by the Vice President's Task Force on Terrorism regarding the control and removal of terrorist aliens in the U.S., unquote. The last sentence again. In June of 1986, a new, quote, Alien Border Control Committee, unquote, was established, again quoting, to implement specific recommendations made by the Vice President's Task Force on Terrorism regarding the control and removal of terrorist aliens in the U.S., unquote. One of its working groups was charged with conducting, quote, a review of contingency plans for removal of selected aliens, unquote. These contingency plans, quote, relating to alien terrorists, anticipated that the INS may be tasked with apprehending and removing from the U.S. a sizable group of aliens, unquote, and again called for housing, quote, up to 5,000 aliens in temporary tent quarters at a camp in Oakdale, Louisiana. As the designated coordinator of counterterrorism in the National Security Council, North would certainly have known of these contingency plans, which, disturbingly enough, appear to still be with us. Yes, indeed, it'll be interesting to see what happens with these contingency plans after the, quote, terrorist aliens, unquote, the alleged perpetrators of the World Trade Center bombing and the shooting outside CIA headquarters, both of them apparently illegal immigrants, whether or not they did what they're supposed to have done. And I would also note, of course, that Mohammed Soleimani is viewed as an Islamic fundamentalist. And it's worth noting that Mr. Khamsi comes from Pakistan, where Islamic fundamentalism is rampant. Also, note also that the Islamic fundamentalist forces in Pakistan were inextricably linked with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And that operation, the long guerrilla war against the Soviet-backed government in Afghanistan, was greatly assisted by the U.S. intelligence community, which thereby became deeply involved in Pakistan and with the Islamic fundamentalist forces there. It'll be interesting to see what comes out of the apparent German connection to Mr. Soleimani and Mr. Nayyad, whether or not the money that was wired to Germany had anything to do with the World Trade Center bombing. I suspect that in addition to the cries for tightening U.S. immigration laws, which we're already seeing, and it'll be interesting to see whether this incident or perhaps subsequent incidents like it, if in fact they happen, serve to call down the provisions that are made to dealing with, quote, terrorist aliens. I suspect that in addition to the calls for tightening U.S. immigration procedures, the German connection may also prove grist for the reactionary political mills in Germany as well. The outrage on the part of Germans at foreigners who are being scapegoated for Germany's economic problems, that outrage, I suspect, will be fueled by the revelation that, in fact, the suspects in the World Trade Center bombing received funding from Germany. I suspect that the far right and fascist elements in Germany, which are gaining strength as a result of their anti-immigrant status, their anti-immigrant stance, I should say, I suspect that they may cite the World Trade Center bombing and the German connection to it as further indication that foreigners are no good, and as a further rationalization for conducting not only the crackdown on immigration that's taking place in Germany, but also the continued violence against foreigners that has dominated the news there in the past months. By the way, I'm not going to get into it today, but I would refer listeners to an article in the This World section, the This World magazine of today's San Francisco Sunday Examiner and Chronicle. Today, for the benefit of people who hear this program on tape, is Sunday, March 14th of 1993. In the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, March 8th of 1993, there was an article by a story by Mark Fisher of the Washington Post. It was datelined Berlin and headlined, German Voters Give Support to Right Wing. German voters in the western state of Hesse sent the country's political establishment a stiff protest message yesterday by delivering strong support in local elections to the extreme right-wing, anti-foreigner Republican Party. In Germany's only elections this year, voters in Hesse, which includes the city of Frankfurt, voiced dismay with both Chancellor Helmut Kohl's Christian Democrats and the main opposition party, the Social Democrats. Most of the votes lost by the majority parties went to the Republicans, an avowedly anti-foreigner party that shot up from 0.1% of the Hessian vote in 1989 to 8% last night. Skipping down on the article, analysts focused as much on the low voter participation, a post-war low of 67%, as on the surging Republicans, whose anti-immigration slogan, quote, the boat is full, unquote, won 15% of the vote in less affluent sections of Frankfurt, where as many as one in five residents are non-German. So note the success that has been achieved by the Republikaner Party, the Republican Party, an explicitly fascist party headed up by a former SS man named Franz Schönhuber. I would note that our own Republican Party would also be classified by the vast majority of objective political observers as fascist. Benito Mussolini would be very, very comfortable with the American Republican Party. Hitler might find it not quite anti-Semitic enough, But Hitler would be very comfortable and would heartily endorse the Republican Ethnic Heritage Groups Council, which we looked at in Radio Free America program number 37, the repository for many explicitly fascist elements, many of them war criminals, and many of them, and all of them, graduates of the fascist movements of the 1930s and 40s. Many of them either participated with or allied themselves with the Third Reich. And again, note that, as we looked at in Radio Free America 37, the German government has actually begun acting in a way which is in concert with the views of the quote, skinheads, unquote, who have been alleged to have alleged to be the sole culprits behind the violence against foreigners in Germany, as we looked at in Radio Free America 37, and in particular in supplements to Radio Free America 37. In fact, German officialdom has been quite supportive of the attacks against foreigners in Germany. And again, note the success of the Republikaner Party that has basically campaigned on an anti-immigrant platform. And remember, that party is headed up by Franz Schönhuber, a former SS man. One of the things that we looked at, not only in Radio Free America 37, but in other Radio Free America shows, including the Guns of November Part 4, Radio Free America shows 1, 2, and 3, Radio Free America shows 14 and 15, as well as programs 21 and 22, one of the things that we've looked at is the very close operational cooperation between the German national security establishment and our own national security establishment, and the significant presence of explicitly fascist elements in both. In particular, we looked at the cooperation between German fascists, many of them graduates of the Third Reich, and reactionary elements in the United States in the assassination of President Kennedy. The basis for that collaboration, of course, is the Gehlen organization, the Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit that has been a major focus of these programs over the years. Briefly, for the benefit of newcomers, General Reinhard Gehlen was Hitler's chief of intelligence for the Eastern Front in World War II. At the end of World War II, Gehlen and his entire organization were basically grafted onto the fledgling CIA, where they became, for all intents and purposes, the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs. The Gehlen organization, for all practical purposes, was the sole purveyor of intelligence on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe in the immediate World War II, post-World War II period. The Gehlen organization eventually became the de facto NATO intelligence organization, and ultimately it became the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the West German intelligence service, which it is to this day. I would note that even after it was incorporated as the West German CIA, in effect, the Gehlen organization continued to be a major purveyor of intelligence to the CIA, and it continued its very close links to the CIA even after it became the BND. The Gehlen organization, as we looked at in Radio Free America 37, and by the way, we've dealt with the Gehlen organization in numerous archive shows, in Radio Free America 37, we looked at the Gehlen organization, which was a direct extension of the German General Staff and intelligence system from World War II. The Gehlen organization is a unique organization in history. Even when it was the West German intelligence service, it continued to wield a massive influence inside the United States as well as in NATO as a whole. And it was basically a unique organization in the annals of intelligence and military affairs. And bear in mind that it was a direct extension and projection of the Third Reich's national security establishment forward, projected forward into the post-World War II period. We're going to take a musical break now, and when we come back, we're going to take a look at some of the other things that have been growing out of the incidents that have been occurring in the past several months. We're going to take a look at some of the things that have been growing out of the shooting in front of the CIA headquarters earlier this year. Bear in mind, again, that the suspect being fingered by U.S. authorities was also an illegal immigrant. He was from Pakistan. And we're going to take a look at the Islamic fundamentalist movement in Pakistan, perhaps also Afghanistan. And we're going to take a look at a devastating series of bombings in India, which may very well ultimately be laid, rightly or wrongly, at the doorstep of Islamic fundamentalists from Pakistan, or Muslim, quote, Muslim extremists from Pakistan, or perhaps Muslim extremists in India. In any event, we're going to touch on that after a musical break, and then we're going to continue with Radio Free America. Well, we're going to continue with Radio Free America 38 after a musical break.